Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, a new study suggests that chemotherapy given to terminal cancer patients who aren't expected to live beyond 6 months may do more harm than good. We'll discuss the pros and cons of chemotherapy for terminal patients, especially when weighed against the effects on quality of life. And we'll also look at the high rate of intensive treatments used in the final months for teens dying of cancer. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A new study published on Thursday of last week in the medical journal JAMA reveals that the administering of chemotherapy at the end of life frequently does more harm than good. The study focused on terminal patients with expectations of no more than 6 months of life, and another separate study looked at end-of-life issues for those in a younger, that is 15 to 30 age bracket. In this hour, we want to discuss the issue of end-of-life care and chemotherapy treatments in light of these two new studies. Also, look into the effect of a new proposed Medicare rule, which would allow for payments for doctors to discuss end-of-life issues. And let me tell you who is joining us for the program. With us from New Haven is Holly Prigerson. She is the director of the Weill Cornell Center for Research on End-of-Life Care, also co-author of the study we're going to be talking about, Chemotherapy Use, Performance, Status, and Quality of Life at the End of Life. And she joins us this morning from New Haven. Welcome, Holly Prigerson.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here, and also glad to have Lowell Schnipper with us. He is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, chairs the Task Force on Value in Cancer Care for the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and is with us this morning from Boston. Welcome, Lowell Schnipper.
Good morning, and thank you.
Glad to have you. And also with us this morning here in studio is Steve Panilat, and he's professor of clinical medicine and director of palliative care program at University of California, San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Glad to have all of you. Holly Prigerson, let me begin with you. This study, which you essentially were the lead author on, has received a great deal of attention, deservedly so, and I want to have our listeners find out exactly what you found out here. The conventional wisdom has always been, well, why not when you're at a terminal phase? What do you have to lose? You go for chemo. There's a possibility in some cases something may result favorably. But the data shows that there are harms, there's costs to getting it so late, and that's basically your bottom line, isn't it?
That's exactly the bottom line, and I think it's actually the response has been somewhat surprising because it seems a no-brainer. It seems so obvious that quality of life would be important to someone who's confronting death, that would be a priority of the things that you would want to focus on and attend to.
And at this point, though, are you essentially saying to people you still have the choice because now there's this new Medicare new Medicare rules that we think are going through in January, which would allow for these conversations to be paid for with doctors. Are you saying, you know, have those conversations and decide, or really saying it would be in the best interest and maybe in the best interest of the guidelines to advise against?
We're not recommending that people either decide to choose chemotherapy or avoid it. But what we are saying is they should have these discussions with their oncologist and know what the goals of treatment are. If the goal is to palliate, if the goal is to improve someone's quality of life, they should see these data. And the data don't confirm that they'll be feeling any better. And in fact, they should realize that if the goal is enhanced survival, they should be very specific at what those expectations are. Are they talking about days, weeks, months? How much longer time, and what's the quality of life of that any added time if there is any that results from getting chemo at that point?
Well, what was the methodology that you used to come up with the conclusions of the study?
So this was a study of advanced solid tumor cancer patients, mostly gastrointestinal cancers and thoracic cancers. And these are people who had progression on at least one or two other lines of chemotherapy. So these are people who have proven chemo refractory and not benefited from chemo in the past, and their oncologists, given that scenario, confirmed that they had a 6 month or less life expectancy. So they were terminally ill patients.
There was another study with terminal patients of a lower age bracket, I think between the ages of 15 and 30, and it's been sort of the job of people like me to help the public separate these two and understand the differences between yours and that other study. Could you do that for us?
Right. Well, ours was a prospective cohort study, so that means that we took the sample of terminally ill patients who had criteria that would suggests that their life expectancy was 6 months or less, and we followed them until they died. And then we had their family caregiver evaluate in about 2 weeks after they died how things went, what their last week of life was, and also we looked at the type of medical care that they got and where they died in the last week of life. So it was following a cohort of very sick, advanced solid tumor cancer patients with chemo-refractory disease, and we wanted to know, okay, so first of all, we wanted to know how many were getting, quote-unquote, palliative chemotherapy, because chemotherapy for that type of patient population isn't intended to cure them. So we wanted to know, all right, so how many people are getting chemotherapy at that point in time, which was approximately 4 months before they had died. And it was over half. And that rate actually in a current study has gone up. So this is not a rare occurrence that patients this sick are being offered chemotherapy, and they should know what the intent of it is. So anyway, back to the study design, we get this cohort of very sick advanced cancer patients and their family members, whom at baseline we have evaluate their quality of life. So we have the patient report their quality of life and their family member report their quality of life for them to see how accurate they are. And they were very accurate. And then we follow them until they died, and then we have that same caregiver evaluate how things went in the last week of life. And these results are from the data that were obtained that way. So we're saying patients at baseline who got chemotherapy versus those who didn't, controlling for the factors associated with getting chemotherapy, predicted dying a worse quality of death.
So are you saying chemotherapy should not be offered routinely?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that patients need to make informed choices, and they need to have those discussions with their oncologist to have a clear mind of what their preferences should be based on data, not on hopes and dreams about what they would like to happen, but on data that say what's likely to happen.
I guess in some ways, let me bring Steve Panilat in this. He's professor of clinical medicine, directs the palliative care program at UC San Francisco. We're looking at this from a number of different angles, Steve, but it boils down to, do you want hospice care or do you want to be on machines in the ICU?
Well, it's really not that choice. That's a false choice that we often offer to patients. And the real benefit comes from trying to offer both, to do the things that we know can help people's quality of life, to offer them palliative care, whether or not they also choose to get chemotherapy or treatment for any other serious illness. And we know that if you can do both at the same time, you can make people's quality of life better. And in some studies, it's been shown that actually offering both can help people live longer than if they get chemotherapy alone.
Are we talking about, because Medicare is presumably recognizing advanced care planning, and this is getting some opposition by right-to-life people, as one could expect, but this is going to change the ground rules, in terms of what we're talking about here?
It's a great idea to encourage these conversations between doctors and patients. I mean, that's really the goal, is for people to make informed choices. It's not that one way is right or wrong, but that you should go in with your eyes open to really understand what the treatments have to offer you. And as Holly said, not to base it on some false hope about what it might do, but to make decisions on what really will help you, and to understand all the treatment options. So often the treatments are limited, or our options are limited, for example, to chemotherapy or nothing. And nobody wants nothing. And that's also a false choice. There's a lot that we do for people with advanced disease like cancer, like heart failure, that's not necessarily directed at the disease, but nonetheless makes them feel better, improves their quality of life, and in many instances can help them live longer as well.
Does this study, though, that Holly Pregerson was director of, does this tell us something different from the other study that was mentioned here, that is vis-a-vis you got younger people and many of them want to stay alive as long as they can for the benefit of their parents? It's very different than those who are at a later phase of life and are terminal.
The studies are telling us slightly different things. The study in the younger adults is just telling us that young people with cancer are getting a lot of very intensive, invasive treatments very close to the end of life. They're getting chemotherapy in the last 2 weeks of life when it's not able to really make a difference. And the study that Holly published is telling us something a little different, similar but slightly different in that chemotherapy is not helping people live longer or feel better. So they're different, but the message is really the same, which is we really have to be very thoughtful about these treatments that are potentially toxic and can be harmful rather than helpful.
Is the choice come down to some extent between palliative care and palliative chemo?
Again, that's also a false choice. It can be both. You can get palliative chemo, and increasingly there are chemotherapy regimens that can be helpful. Again, the question is, go in with eyes open. Don't wish that the chemotherapy is going to help you live better and longer when the studies suggest that it won't. And regardless, get palliative care, because we know that that will not only help you feel better, could help you live longer, and importantly, there's never been a study of palliative care that has shown any harm. So it's a risk-free intervention.
Let me bring Lowell Stempner into this. He's, again, professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School and chairs the Task Force on Value in Cancer Care for the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And I noticed, Lowell Stempner, that in 2012, the American Society for Clinical Oncology listed chemotherapy at the end of life as one of the five treatments to avoid.
Yes, I think it's been known for a long time that chemotherapy, as an individual's life is winding down secondary to advanced cancer, particularly when the cancer has not responded favorably to other treatments, tends to have little or no good effect. And as this study and as other clinical experiences point out, there are certainly side effects that make things worse. There are many reasons to commend this study because it codifies a really important area of oncology that doesn't get enough attention, and that is attention to the patient's quality of life. You know, one of the things that clinical investigators in cancer medicine rely on is objective measurements or metrics to tell us if a treatment is doing what we're hoping it's going to do. In the case of advanced cancer, many of the clinical trials with drug X, Y, or Z are determined to be successes or failures based on what happens to the cancer itself, meaning does it shrink, or how long does it take, or how many months or weeks go by before the cancer starts growing again after the treatment or the intervention. And not enough study is actually devoted to the questions that are included in this study, which are, how does the patient feel while you're getting all this? And, you know, the interesting proviso here is that using classical chemotherapy, which is what I surmise most of the patients receive, even people whom guidelines suggest are appropriate candidates for palliative chemotherapy didn't feel better, on the whole, as a result of getting such treatment. So, you know, what do we take from this? Well, first and foremost, I think Holly, actually both guests have already said it. This is a call to say we as doctors need to have candid conversations with our patients. And that is hard. You know, you mentioned the possible Medicare change in regulations to compensate for such conversations. That may help some. My guess is that these are existential issues that affect the doctor and the patient in many ways, some similar, some different, and that docs just have a hard time with such a conversation, despite the fact that we at the medical schools and teaching hospitals, I know, have been trying over and over again to train people, to teach people about the importance of doing just this. It's not only about getting compensated, although maybe that's a piece of it. There's a much larger and very important aspect, and that is sitting across the desk or the bed from somebody who is desperate to live longer and telling them in the most candid and gentle way you know how that that's just not possible, and we need to try to give you the best treatment we know how that will keep you as healthy as possible for a long period of time.
But as much as you commend the study, you're not saying, or let me rephrase it, you think it might be premature to change the guidelines. There needs to be, in fact, more study of treatment effects.
Well, let me put this out as a consideration and for, in fact, the other guests to react to. The study was done between 2002 and 2008. It's now 7 years after the last entrance to the study, last period. Cancer treatments have evolved to some extent, admittedly rather slowly, and for solid tumors, much more slowly than any of us would like. But there are increasing indicators that molecular analyses are likely to identify individual patients based on what we call biomarkers who might in fact have the opportunity to respond rather favorably with much less toxicity than with classical chemotherapy to targeted treatments. I just put that out as an example, not because it currently is the rule of the day, because it isn't, but there is an enormous amount of attention going on to defining cancer by cancer what genetic aberrations occur. And by the biotech industry and labs all over the country are attempting to find treatments that specifically respond to aberrant mutations that are driving cancers. Yeah. So I don't know if any of the patients who were currently in this study fast forwarded to 2015, if their tumors were analyzed genetically, would have a meaningful therapy that wouldn't be very toxic.
I'm glad you put that question out there.
But the point I'm making is that to put all of the conclusions of this study into the context of 7, 10, perhaps 15 years later would be a little bit unfair. So it needs a much more nuanced set of discussions and thoughts, both with the patient and among professionals.
Yeah, I think I'm hearing you, Holly Pregerson.
Yes, we actually have a proposal to do that, to do this study that looks at what are the motivating factors, what do patients know, what do doctors share, why are what are they told about the likely intent of treatment, and to look at more current treatments. One of the questions I'd pose back to Dr. Schnipper is, in deciding on the new value calculations about value in cancer care, is quality of life a metric? Is quality of life one of the criteria on which you determine value in cancer, or is it all just focused on tumor shrinkage? So the problem that I have with the logic as someone who's not an oncologist is the goal of chemotherapy, as I understand it, for this set of patients, is to shrink a tumor. That response is defined by shrinking a tumor. The correlation, I've been scouring the literature, the correlation between tumor shrinkage and longer life isn't that strong. I mean, it's significantly associated.
To Dr. Pregerson's point, in the value framework that we recently published, we actually categorized two fundamental clinical scenarios, one being the scenario of the advanced disease patient, which is exactly the population of patients in Dr. Pregerson's study, and also what we call the adjuvant or the potentially curative setting. In the advanced disease setting, our value framework provides bonus points, meaning we add to the concept of clinical benefit and value for measurable improvements in patients' symptoms. So the answer to Dr. Pregerson's question about do we value or provide some measure of importance for quality of life The answer is sort of. And the reason it's sort of is because we felt that in this framework, we had to rely on the evidence that's provided in the medical literature from properly done randomized trials. All too often, quality of life is not adequately measured in clinical trials that are comparing two different treatments.
Well, forgive me. It occurs to me, I want to actually go to Stephen Padelaide on this, because it occurs to me that there, just as we're learning more about biometrics and molecular structures, as Lo Schnipper is suggesting, we're also learning a lot more about the effect of chemo, aren't we, and the toxicity of chemo?
Well, traditional chemo can be very, very toxic. We've known that for a really long
time. There's new articles about chemo brain, and there's new language about it and so forth.
Correct. Absolutely. And we see this in the hospital. People who've had lots of chemotherapy are not the same. There really are serious impacts, lasting impacts on the brain and other parts of the body that from chemotherapy that are the reason why at the end of the day your quality of life is not made better by all these treatments. But in fact, you know, you can sometimes, as Holly was saying, you can make the cancer smaller and the patient isn't doing any better. And that's why we want to focus on the patient, the person with the disease, not the disease itself, to see what we can do to make them feel better.
I just have to get this in here because I was struck by a study that came out of Stanford that you probably are aware of, that maybe all of our panelists are aware of, a new study that says that doctors would choose less aggressive end-of-life care. It came out to over 80% of those doctors who were queried. Those are the ones who are responsible for helping patients make these decisions.
Yes. Yes, it's very interesting to look at what doctors who see this every day would choose for themselves and what they feel in some ways compelled to offer their patients. And the point that was made earlier about how difficult it is to talk to our patients about these issues is really important. These are not easy things to talk about, to have to tell someone that the treatments that you've been offering are not helping, that they're unlikely to help in the future, that they are dying, that they have limited prognosis. Those are things that are not easy to do. And I have many colleagues who tell me, you know, Steve, I'm sitting there in the office and I have a patient and I know that my treatment won't help, but they start crying and telling me I have to do something and I'm an hour and a half behind in clinic and I don't know what to say. So I say, just come back on Thursday and we'll figure out something and I'll give you something.
It's just that feeling of needing to do something that so many people have for their loved ones, for themselves, and in many respects. Well, the data is out there now in this new study, and that's really what we're talking about. A question arising about aggressive cancer treatment at the end of life, and a new study suggesting that chemotherapy given to terminal cancer patients who are not expected to live beyond 6 months may do more harm than good. We're talking about the pros and cons of chemotherapy for terminal patients, especially when weighed against the effects on quality of life. And let me invite you who are listening to join us. You can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. That number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in the program. Any questions, comments, or personal experiences you may want to bring into the conversation, you are welcome to join us by phone. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Talking with Steve Padelaide, who's here in studio with us, professor of clinical medicine, director of the palliative care program at UC San Francisco. Holly Prigerson, who is director of the Weill Cornell Center for Research on End-of-Life Care and co-author of the study, Chemotherapy Use, Performance, Status, and Quality of Life at the End of Life. And Lowell Schnipper, professor of medicine at Harvard, chair of the Task Force on the Value in Cancer Care for the American Society of Clinical Oncology. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about questions arising around aggressive cancer treatment at the end of life. New study shows that chemotherapy given to terminal cancer patients who aren't expected to live beyond 6 months may do more harm than good. And Holly Prigerson is with us, who essentially is the author of that study, director of the Weill Cornell Center for Research on End-of-Life Care, co-author of the study, Chemotherapy Use, Performance, Status, and Quality of Life at the End of Life. And Lowell Schnipper with us from Boston is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and chairs the Task Force on Value in Cancer Care for the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And Stephen Padelaide is here in studio, professor of clinical medicine and director of the palliative care program at UC San Francisco. We're going to your calls and emails. First, I want to go to Dr. Padelaide. Steve, you were saying well, something off air that I want to get on air. But before we do that, let's just I don't want these two studies to be confabulated or to be confused. So can you just lay it? One came out a week ago. One came out the week before.
Correct. one difference.
And one is about teens and one is about – I mean, draw the lines for us.
Sure. So the study in young adults is a study that looked backwards. It sort of said, let's look at all the people between 15 and 39 who had cancer within this Kaiser Southern California population. So let's look at all of them. There were 663 of those young people, and they died of cancer. And I said, okay, now let's get this group and let's just see what happened to them. So this is all the people who meet these criteria. Let's go back now. Let's review their records and see what happened to them. And it reports what the experience was, what care they received very close to the end of life. So it's limited to young people, younger people. And it's looking backwards to say, if you died of cancer over this 10-year period, what kind of care did you receive? And it reports that. And what it shows is that lots and lots of people, 60-plus percent of those people received some sort of invasive care, meaning they were hospitalized in the intensive care unit, received chemotherapy within the last 2 weeks of life. The study by Holly Pregerson and her colleagues was they took all people with metastatic cancer and a limited prognosis, 6 months or less. They looked at them at entry to the study. They enrolled them in their study and then they followed them forward to see what would happen to them. So first, it was not limited to younger adults. And second, they were able to collect the information they were interested in, like their quality of life, which you wouldn't find in typical databases, as was done with the young adults. That's just whatever lives in the chart. Here they were able to ask the questions they were most interested in around quality of life and follow them forward over time, then go back to their family members and reassess their quality of life very close to the end of life and therefore draw conclusions about quality of life and the impact of chemotherapy.
And you're also talking about, maybe we can get Lois Knipper to comment on this, a Harvard study on quality of life that was done a number of years ago.
That's right. It's a study that was published in 2010 in the New England Journal of Medicine by one of our colleagues, Jennifer Temel, and her group. They looked at people with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. This is cancer of the lung that is not curable at the time of diagnosis. Average survival with that disease is about 9 months. And what they did is every patient in that study received chemotherapy, but half the patients were then randomly assigned to receive palliative care in addition. And then they followed them forward. And what they found was that the people who were randomized to receive palliative care in addition to their chemotherapy felt better. They had a better quality of life. They had less pain. They had less depression, and importantly, they lived longer by over 2.5 months. In a disease where the prognosis was 9 months, they lived 2.5 months longer because they got palliative care along with their chemotherapy.
Lois Knipper, that seems like a pretty significant study to me.
You know, yeah, I think we all have sort of seen that study as a very, very important and convincing argument for incorporating palliative care early into the treatment of somebody with advanced cancer. In other words, these people with lung cancer that were just referred to were at the start of their journey with advanced stage lung cancer. These were not necessarily people with 4 or 6 months to live. And yet the question was, how would they do if they were offered palliative therapy along with the standard type of anti-cancer chemotherapy? And as you just heard, they actually had a better quality of life. And there are some suggestions from that study that they lived longer. I mean, the author of the study, Jennifer Temel, points out that the primary goal of the study and its design was not to ask length of life questions. So she regards that as probable but not necessarily a convincing aspect of it. But I think it's fair to say that people in general had a better experience. And I think that has really motivated many, many oncologists to try to build palliative care into the treatment of individuals with advanced and incurable cancer. No doubt about it.
Well, Holly Pregerson, have you been hearing anything about death panels resurfacing in this whole?
No, I published a paper about 5 years ago on end-of-life discussions, and that generated a whole bunch of noise about death panels and concerns. I actually have trouble understanding the logic of death panels and why it would be so threatening to have full information and discuss options in a realistic way, why that's considered a death panel. It doesn't mean that there's any sort of rationing of care. All we're saying is people should have information. Quality of life should be a priority and an important endpoint for people who are confronting death, and that should be part of the discussion. So I'm very happy that Medicare is going to start reimbursing physicians and nurses for having these discussions. But the missing piece from the discussion, and I find it surprising, has been a discussion of how chemotherapy is likely to make a patient feel.
Let me bring up one other thing here, and it's a little bit of a wild card, but, you know, I can remember getting into some pretty heated arguments back in the day with people like Bernie Siegel, you know, who pretty much a Yale professor of medicine who took, I'm being reductive here, but took the line in arguing that cancer had a lot to do with forgiving and coming to peace with yourself and, you know, your mental attitude, all those kinds of things, which a lot of people, I suppose, will say, I don't know if I eat right and if I think right and everything, if I might be able to beat this cancer, so let me have the chemo. What do you say to those patients? I mean, just as a practicing physician.
Well, as a practicing oncologist, I will say that I have always been very uncomfortable with Bernie Siegel's understanding and approach. I don't feel that it's appropriate to more or less raise issues that blame a patient for their own cancer.
Hooray!
I didn't eat the right thing. I didn't do whatever. And what's more, I do believe that cancer fundamentally is a biological and genetic disease. And as a result, it will yield when we're smart enough to figure out appropriate ways to make it yield that are medicinal. There's no doubt that we can provide supportive care, palliative care, psychosocial supportive care that helps an individual manage this very, very tense and frightening journey.
Yeah,
I strongly object to the Siegel approach.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Like I said, I got some heated arguments back in the day because it seemed to put a lot of the guilt and the onus on the patients themselves. Let me bring our callers into this. Let's begin, Gwen, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. The question I have for the panel is that I haven't heard any mention of tumor biomarkers and genome testing for cancer. And my understanding, I'm a psychologist and a nurse, is that that is a very effective way to find exactly what a medication or drug can treat that specific person's cancer. And if I could please get some feedback from the panel about what is your understanding about using tumor biomarkers and how that may help end-of-life use of chemotherapy.
Well, Lowell Snipner brought that up before. I don't know who wants to address this.
Yes, I'm happy to address that again. Thank you for the question. The idea of biomarkers relates to our inquiring about a cancer and learning whether or not a particular protein within and expressed by the cancer can serve as an indicator that tells us this cancer can be treated with a new drug X, or because of the absence of any biomarker that tells us treatment will be useful, it's very likely nothing we know will help to treat this cancer. So biomarkers are increasingly being sought after for all cancer types because they can tell us a little bit more than we know by looking at the cancer under a microscope what the patient's prognosis might be. And also, it can predict whether or not treatments we have will be responsive. So it's an area of enormous importance and enormous research, and we know far, far too little. And my one criticism about anybody who says that no treatment should be the default when cancer is advanced, one treatment has already failed, and therefore just stop all cancer-directed treatment, my one concern about that is that it does not pay adequate attention to the rapidly developing area of biomarker research. And so every oncologist who's well-informed should make sure that their patient's cancer, before they're ready to have this no-treatment discussion with them, is understood to have no biomarkers that suggest a therapy might be available that can be helpful with actually relatively little toxicity.
Again, Lowell Snipner is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. And let me thank the call and go back to you, Holly Pregerson.
Well, one question I have about the immunotherapies is, what are the data on side effects and quality of life, how these newer drugs affect quality of life? So if there are data that say that, yes, they're very effective, you can identify the genetic aberration that to target effectively that will respond to the agent, that's fine. But what are the consequences for side effects?
I think that question
the
is to you.
The treatment itself does induce some side effects. The side effects that are very severe affect a minority of the patients, and a number of these immune modulatory treatments have resulted in individuals destined to die of melanoma living for as many as 2 years. So what we need to do again is sit in front of our patient with an advanced malignant melanoma and explain to them we have a treatment that might help 30% of people like you have an extended period of survival from X number of months to two or three times that number of months. The possibilities are that this drug can cause endocrinology disturbances or colitis. We can treat all of the things that happen, but you are going to be possibly exposed to these consequences. You know, it needs a discussion, something like that. It's not capable of having a black and white discussion. It needs detail and nuance.
All right. I'm going to bring in more of our callers here. David, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to explain a little bit about my mother's story. She died in 02 of ovarian cancer after hysterectomy and lasted a good 6 years after that. But in the meantime, had a stroke, did more chemotherapy when it metastasized. Let's see, that would have been like in 2000. So what happened was, I think she almost had symptoms by that point of PTSD. It was like the treatments themselves were affecting her ability to make decisions, and that's really important for that stage of making decisions, to the point where we had a lawyer, we come in to give me power of attorney, and he refused because she was not capable. So it almost has a legal effect if the treatments are unnecessary to the point where they can't make the proper decisions at that point in their life.
Yeah, you're raising an important point here. Steve Penley is talking about something that's often been called medical fog or chemo brain that happens under chemotherapy. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. We see that the effects of treatment are long-lasting and very serious and really impair someone's ability to think, to function. And at the end of the day, they're made worse off for the treatment, not better. And that's why we want to have these discussions early in the course of illness so that we can really target treatment. The last caller was talking about, you know, biomarkers and genes and targeting treatments, but we have to remember that we're all human beings and we are more than our genes. And just as we are more than our genes in the way we live our lives, we're more than that in the way we choose treatments and in the way we face illness. And the beauty of palliative care is that it really looks at the entire person, their spiritual experience, their psychological experience, their physical experience, to look at the whole person and provide holistic whole person care that targets treatments at the person and not just the disease.
And all the things that come about, like sleep disturbances and fatigue and mood problems and pain relief in general. I mean, those are all kind of sort of under the rubric of palliative care. And let
Absolutely.
Me thank David for his call. Let me go back, Holly Pergerson, to you, if I may. I've got a question here from a listener named Jean, who says, what consideration, she's asking about your study, was given to the financial impact of continuing chemotherapy with this end-of-life patients? Money is always a factor when making medical decisions, and I'm wondering if it was one of the study variables.
We actually did examine whether people who were actually, I should look at the table, but I don't think there was any significant association between health insurance coverage or the income No, there wasn't an association with education. So the more educated people were more likely to get chemotherapy than those who were less educated. But we didn't find a significant confound of financial status on the likelihood of getting chemo versus not. But that's sort of a geeky answer. The financial implications of all of this are ginormous. Their financial incentives on the parts of hospitals, on the parts of cancer centers, on the parts of oncologists, and there's what they call financial toxicity on the parts of from the patients and families' perspectives in terms of what they're spending on care for someone who's dying. They say a quarter of the Medicare budget goes to the last year of life, and 40% of those costs are for the last month of life, spent largely with intensive care units. Stays. So the financial implications of these decisions are huge. We've tried to not focus on cost because we're not trying to say it's worth it or it's not. That's not the point of what our paper was. The point of our paper was to say it's not curative chemotherapy. This therapy's so-called palliative chemotherapy. Does it palliate? Does it make people feel better or worse? What are the consequences for a dying person of being on chemo versus not? The cost implications are huge. And I actually would like my fellow discussants to respond to the financial incentives to or not to treat someone with chemotherapy.
See, panelists?
So, Dr. Brigason's point.
This is lost up there first.
As chair of the Value Task Force for ASCO, we've actually devoted lots and lots of energy to trying to help individuals by developing this framework and using the framework to precipitate a conversation between doctors and patients, specifically to point out what the health benefit of a given treatment might be for an advanced cancer patient, and to present that person with what often is a modest clinical benefit. As people were saying, it may be just weeks or even a few months of extended survival, but with a cost that sometimes is of astonishing magnitude. For the average middle-class American family, the kinds of out-of-pocket costs that families and patients are exposed to with the use of very expensive cancer treatment modalities is sometimes backbreaking. And in fact, a great concern is that medical illness in the United States is one of the primary, if not the primary, cause of personal bankruptcy. So I couldn't agree more with Dr. Brigason's suggestion and the callers that cost, although probably not factored into the study at issue in JAMA Oncology, cost is a huge factor because the debt that individuals sometimes incur just to pay their medical bills probably has profound implications for a family that's not only lost someone important to them, but it may in fact impact kids going to college, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, Dr. Panelli, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, it's true that there are financial incentives, and yet my experience in working with lots and lots of oncologists and lots of physicians is that while those financial incentives exist, really what motivates doctors is wanting to do well by their patients. And I always say that doctors are motivated out of love for their patient, and they want to help. And if the way they know how to help is with chemotherapy, that's what they want to use because they believe in their treatment and they really want to help their patients feel better. And one of the goals we have is to try and help people have more tools, if you will, in their toolkit, so that chemotherapy isn't the only way to demonstrate caring and love for patients, and that we can do that in other ways by focusing on their symptoms, by addressing their psychosocial distress, by, you know, helping them feel better when we know that one treatment won't work, to have lots of other treatments that are available that will help them.
Let me go to a couple of emails, and then I'll try to get to some more of your calls. I wanted to read this email from a listener named Dick, who writes, "My wife was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer over 5 years ago. The oncologist, only when pressed, indicated her life expectancy was 6 months without chemo, 1 year plus with chemo. Hope prevailing, we chose chemo. Bad choice. She was given the prevailing gold standard chemo regimen. The chemo resulted in devastation of her quality of life, resulting in severe nausea, tiredness, depression, and a variety of other side effects with no improvement in her condition at the three-month checkpoint. A second regimen was suggested, resulting in even worse physical side effects, and after 2 weeks, we decided to discontinue the regimen. She lived a total of 7 months after diagnosis. The chemo did not extend her life, but 1 month from the original six-month estimate and totally ruined her quality of life." Here's another listener who writes, "I'm a geriatrician in the Bay Area, and I find that there is increasingly a difference between the approach of oncologists and primary care physicians geriatricians to cancer treatment. When my focus is on quality of life and not ending the cancer, I end up looking like a pessimistic doctor to patients when I recommend palliative end-of-life care. I think we should do a better job when we start cancer treatment of making the facts about palliative care known to the patients who are diagnosed with cancer with a bad prognosis. I presume all of us on the panel are in agreement on that?
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
Okay. Let me bring another caller in then, and this is Mary. Good morning, Mary. You're on.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I come from the perspective of being a chaplain in a hospital at Stanford in Palo Alto, and it was part of a training period I have for being a priest. And I've had that experience where there was an amazing doctor who had amazing experience in the bone marrow transplant unit, and it just got to the point where there was nowhere else to go. And it was so difficult for him to give that news because he was all about caring and he was all about curing. And it was nothing about money. It was nothing about it wasn't about quality of life for him, because his lens was that curing it would create that quality of life. And so what I would say is it's really important to have that perspective of someone who is actually trained to talk about end-of-life issues, to talk about the balance between living for 6 months without chemo and not being sick and spending it with your family, and living for 9 months and being sick all the time. I'm a priest. I've been a priest for 7 years, and I have counseled many people that the quality of life is way more important, and many people need permission to say, yes, I'd rather live for 6 months with my family and in relationship with my family than 9 months being sick. It takes a lot. It takes counseling, and it takes very frank conversation, and often it takes permission.
Well, since you're bringing up some, it seems to me, some really germane questions, and thank you so much, Mary, for that call. I want to go to another caller named Evelyn, because she's sort of dovetailing on this, thinking that maybe, or raising a question about who's appropriate to have those conversations with. Evelyn, go ahead.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I was at Yale Graduate School of Nursing, and I saw how nurses were trained to be, have empathy and to really listen to what patients wanted. I also did pet therapy at Kaiser Hospital in Oakland with on the oncology for pediatrics, and also had that same dog later go have lymphoma and go through 2 years. So I wondered, are there choices we can give patients about degrees of chemotherapy? At Kaiser, the children were in for the chemo, I think, one weekend in a month, and then they were out and living their lives, and they seemed to do so well.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. It's a great comment. A great comment about the role of nurses. And we've talked a lot about doctors. We've talked a lot about oncologists here. But we do have to remember that medicine is a team sport, and healthcare is a team sport. And you know, in palliative care, our focus really is on having a team. We have chaplains on our team. We have nurses, social workers, and doctors who work together. Because when people are really sick, the issues that they're facing and the concerns that they have are not purely medical. They really span the gamut of all the kinds of issues that that are relevant to human beings. And we need to be able to address all of those issues and really take full advantage of everyone's skills in the system to help our patients.
And I think Holly Pergerson wanted to say something.
While that's true, and it is a team sport, we actually did an analysis based on the new Medicare reimbursement of people.
Wait a minute. Why am I responding to the use of the word sport in this? I don't know if you want to call it a sport, but go ahead.
Yeah. I'm sorry. The point is, we did an analysis where oncologists were compared to nurses in terms of the impact of their discussions on patients understanding their prognosis and the intent of treatment. And for better or worse, we found a huge difference between the impact when a patient met with their oncologist and their oncologist said the very same thing that their nurse said. So what I wouldn't want is for oncologists, quite frankly, to be off the hook in terms of their responsibility for communicating effectively and honestly with their patients, because sometimes if they were to shirk that responsibility, patients might not believe what others are telling them about their prognosis. So we have data that really point to the importance of oncologists specifically being very honest and frank and having those discussions and not say, you know, I wasn't trained to have these discussions. That's really not my background. A nurse would be much better than I would. All that might be true, and that can supplement the oncologist discussion, but our data support the genuine importance of an empathic, good communicator among oncologists.
Well, we got seconds left. I'd love to hear from you on this, Lochnepper, if you could be quick about it.
I want to agree with Dr. Brigason completely. I think this is the doctor's responsibility, and it's one that nonetheless can be tense and difficult for the physician who wants to provide a measure of hope, but I think it cannot be ducked at all. Nurses and others, chaplains, definitely have a huge role to play, but there really is the individual to whom the patient is turning for an authoritative response. Can I be helped? Can I not be helped? And an honest, credible answer is do them.
We will need to leave it there. Thank you, Losh Schnepper, who is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Thanks to Steve Panellette here in studio with us, professor of clinical medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. And thanks to Holly Prigerson, who directs the Weill Cornell Center for Research on the End of Life Care, who is co-author of the study we've been talking about, which again is Chemotherapy, Use, Performance, Status, and Quality of Life at the End of Life. You can continue this discussion online at kqed.org/forum. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Chinese railroad workers. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.